Hello? It's always interesting to see which table seems to have the most dynamic conversation. I think this table gets the award, but we're about to, we'll just pause for a second. We're about to start. So my name is Tom Easton. I'm with The Economist, and it's my pleasure to introduce Roy Jakobowitz from Axion today. I won't say very much except to say that I don't know how familiar any of you are with microfinance. You know, I think there's a pretty good case that could be made that microfinance is, in fact, the world's oldest business. But if you wanted to talk about the modern era of microfinance, you might, with some plausibility, say it began. This table is still going on. You might say the modern era of microfinance began in the early 1960s when an American tennis player oddly ended up on a Goodwill tour of Latin America and was so stunned by the poverty that he saw, he built the beginnings of a network of small financial institutions, which has now manifested itself in Axion, Mr. Jakobowitz's group. And therefore, all the things we've seen in microfinance today, we all know Grameen and Brock and all these terrific organizations, Women's World Banking, that are in existence around the world, but really the progenitor of this modern generation is Axion. And it's very interesting that Axion is one of the two foreign institutions that has recently been able to obtain a license to do business in China. Now, as we all know, finance in China is a very, very difficult proposition. So it's my pleasure to introduce Mr. Jakobowitz to you and have him describe the trials that Axion has been through so far in trying to establish this venture in China and what he sees going forward. We will have a brief talk, and then we'll have plenty of time for all of your questions. Thank you very much.
Thanks very much, Tom. And thank you all for coming. And I'll try and do my best to keep you entertained for about 20 minutes and then entertain your questions. So I am Roy Jakobowitz. I'm the Managing Director for External Affairs for Axion International. Axion is a U.S.-based 501c3 not-for-profit organization. I've worked for Axion since 1994, and since 1997 been a member of the senior management team. What I'm going to talk about today is microfinance in China and international best practice in microfinance. And can international best practice in microfinance, which we'll talk about a lot, risk management was the essential characteristic that made it possible for anyone in a formal way to make loans to poor people, poor entrepreneurs, as a poverty alleviation method. And so for those who are not familiar with microfinance, that is the essence of what microfinance is. Very small loans to very poor people to help them grow their businesses, stabilize household income, et cetera. So let me give you some background first. Axion was founded in 1961, as Tom said, by Tom Blatchford and a couple of colleagues. And then in 1970, and the basic, our basic methodology at that time was to be a private sector Peace Corps, training university graduates, sending them to Latin America, and having them do pretty standard community development projects with the particular emphasis on not providing answers, but asking questions of the people that they were there to serve, what is it that they would see as being most effective for developing their communities, and that is what led us to microfinance. Because in Recife, Brazil, in 1972, a group of these volunteers were working in a marketplace with very small vendors and producers who said, we have these tiny businesses, we can't make them grow because we can't get access to capital. If we borrow from the loan sharks take all the profit. So can you make us a loan? That started a 10-year research project into how do you effectively loan money to poor people and get it back. and make those loans in such a way that they actually contribute to the business development of the poor people and thereby help to alleviate their poverty. Oh, and by the way, let's see if we can't do it, because it's a financial transaction, let's do it in a financially self-sustaining manner in hopes of creating a poverty alleviation method that can sustain itself and get to significant scale without depending on endless charitable contributions for its growth. This has led us to build a network of 32 institutions, or 30 in 22 countries worldwide, and those are long-term partners with whom, some of whom we've worked with for the last 30 years. Taken together, which have a portfolio of over $3.6 billion, average loan size a little less than $900, with 3.7 active borrowers at year-end 2008. Loss rate since 1973, a little less than 3%. And this brings us to one of the key elements which made microfinance possible, and also will make microfinance particularly innovative and difficult in China, and that is credit risk management. You don't lend $19 billion over 40 years to over 15 million poor people and experience a loss rate less than 3% unless you're managing your credit risk. And this was one of the primary innovations that Acción and other and our some of our colleague institutions were able to develop to make it possible to use this. And that is based in a history of innovations. I'm not going to go through the whole history, but a couple of things are particularly important to note. And that is especially the period of growth between 1986 and 1999, when Acción was the leader in the process of commercializing microfinance, going from a not-for-profit activity that depended on donations and preferential rate loans from USAID and U.S.-based foundations to business-like operations that could withstand the due diligence and scrutiny of capital markets in order to access commercial capital and take away access to capital as the basic limit or obstacle to growth of these institutions. So during this period, what we were able to do was, in the early 80s, we used to throw a party every time we reached 1,000 clients in a new institution. And by the end of the 90s, we would throw a party at 10,000 clients. And at the end of the next decade, we would throw a party at 100,000 clients. So, and this was made possible by commercializing microfinance and accessing commercial capital. Since the year 2000, we have expanded from Latin America worldwide, first to sub-Saharan Africa, then to India, and now to China. It's worth noting that underlying a commitment to commercial and financially rational operations is a commitment to social development, and most recently exemplified by a commitment to a campaign and a set of principles for client protection, protecting the rights of microfinance borrowers through instituting six basic principles, which include transparent and fair pricing, integrity of data, ethical practice by loan officers and others. And this is in order to, while emphasizing commercial operations, to build structures which also maintain social development, the social development goals. So now that gets us sort of who Acción is and how we got to where we are today. Microfinance broadly in China, our market research shows a huge untapped market. There are, at the bottom of the pyramid, there are lots of savings vehicles available, but almost no bottom of the pyramid credit. There are a few hundred MFI operators, almost all of which are NGOs, and with only two or three exceptions, all of which are small, fewer than 3,000 clients, and with one or two exceptions, all of which have not been able to achieve financial break-even. There have been hundreds of licenses issued to undertake microfinance activity, issued to local entities, but there is almost no expertise. There's no knowledge, and the number of foreign institutions that are bringing best practices, there are only two or three, and that those best practices have not yet penetrated the market at all. There is enormous bottom of the pyramid installed capacity amongst the Postal Service banks and the rural credit cooperatives, but neither of them are reaching down far enough down market with credit products. And they are also have all of the problems, at least the postal savings banks have all the problems of being government entities as well. So international MFIs that are operating in China, Acción, had applied for in the fall of 2006 a license that was made possible in a group of 20 pilot licenses by the PBOC, the People's Bank of China. 20 licenses were available, distributed through provincial governments. We applied for and received a license to operate the Inner Mongolia Acción Microcredit Company, which will operate in three districts of the Qifeng Prefecture. We are in the process of capitalizing the company this month. The capital will go through a capital verification process and begin lending by the end of September. We have on staff 18 trained loan officers, two branches where the leasehold improvements have already been made, installed MIS. We're ready to go as soon as the company is fully capitalized and licensed. Planet Finance, which is a Paris-based international microfinance expert, has a similar license. They're operating in Nanchong, in Sichuan. And as of the end of 2007, they had about 900 active clients. They are probably in the 2,500 to 3,000 range right now. Grameen Foundation USA was the progenitor of many of the NGO microlenders in China, and they are also attempting to get a license to operate a non-bank financial corporation similar to the pilot license that we have. Discussed the licenses. There are also, besides these pilot microfinance licenses, there also is for commercial banks issued by the Central Bank of China what are called village bank licenses. The village bank licenses are available for commercial operating banks that would like to serve the microfinance market. The fundamental differences between our license and the village banking license: under village banking, you can capture savings, but the interest rate caps are much more severe. We'll talk about the obstacles and limitations to microfinance in just a second. Standard Chartered Bank has received a license also to operate a village bank also in Inner Mongolia, and I understand that Citibank has also received a license. So what's the skill set that international microfinance institutions could bring to Chinese microfinance? Here's a quick list of the things that we do normally when we move from market to market. And for Acción's purposes, having moved from Latin America to sub-Saharan Africa and to India successfully, we have proven our ability to adapt the basic principles to new economic and social circumstances. But from this list, you can see that there's an enormous amount of rigor required in order to do responsible microfinance. I'm not going to go through the whole list, but just point out one, which I started to talk about a little bit earlier, and that is credit risk management. Microfinance business cycles, the businesses of poor people have really fast business cycles. And the average term in a microfinance portfolio, in our microfinance portfolio worldwide, is between 6 and 9 months. But many poor people are operating businesses that are literally turning over week to week. So if there's a problem with a loan, it can go bad very quickly. And so in the credit evaluation and in the disbursement, you have to be certain of the capacity to repay. And if there's a late payment, you have to intervene very quickly to find out what the problem is and help that borrower to fix it. Otherwise, the portfolio can deteriorate. Portfolio quality can deteriorate very quickly. This is best practice in microfinance, and it's also expensive. And another thing that we all know is true about finance in China, risk management broadly is not the strongest area of finance in China. So bringing this kind of rigor in microfinance also brings a very high cost structure for microfinance. Many of you, I'm sure, know that a normal bank measures its efficiency operating cost to average portfolio, and any bank that goes higher than 4 isn't a bank anymore, it's bankruptcy. The most efficient microfinance institutions in the world are operating, and there are only 4 or 5 of these, are operating at operating cost to average portfolio in the range of 10 to 12. The other joke in microfinance is there are only 2 kinds of people in the world who see their banker regularly, the very wealthy and the very poor. The Acción is going to bring its best practice methodology to China, but we've got severe interest rate caps. We have severe leverage limitations. And we also have severe geographic limitations. So in all of Qifeng, a city of 1.4 million, we only have 3 prefectures, population maybe only 500,000, from which we project building only a 15,000 active clients over 4 years and to barely get to break even. Can it be done? Can we get it right? Can we use these international best practices as rigorous and as expensive and as limited as we are by the regulatory environment? Can we do it right, demonstrate that it can be done, and still get to financial break even? Because while the regulator has put us into this very small box, lend your own money with the leverage limitation, don't charge very much, and stay within this fixed geographic area, but do it fast and demonstrate the effectiveness of it, we have a short time frame for success. This is the risk that Acción has taken for itself, and the truth be told, we don't know. We don't know, planet doesn't know, what will be the reality in China. What do we know? We know that our basic back office practices will work. We know how to manage the finances of a small microfinance bank. We know how to build an MIS system. We know how to open branches and operate them. But we have a lot to learn about the front of the office: product design, marketing, human resources, what kind of people do we need to hire and how do we train them? And frankly, we're going to be learning that. And, invite me back in a few years and let you know how we did. It's not going to be easy, but we're looking forward to the challenge. I think I've spoken long enough. Let me sit down and take your questions.
have to say, I think that was not only a terrific presentation, that was the most humble presentation I've seen. Can everyone hear me? I think that was the most humble presentation I've seen in the 3 years I've been in Hong Kong, because it was the first one that I've heard that really acknowledged both the ambition but also the possibilities or the complications that really could intrude and preclude success. Anyway, I would like to go directly to questions. Yes, please. Please identify yourself as well before you ask.
David Peace. I'm the CEO of Univisk in Asia Pacific. We provide microservices. But the one question I have here is quite an important one about regulatory challenges. The three key KPIs in microfinance are outreach, sustainability, and then benefits. the outreach, there's about 150 million people online now, but a lot more to go. And there's a quicksand here being caused by arguments between the banks and the telcos in regulating, in removing cash and getting mobile banking into the rural areas. How do you see that?
The basic question here is how will the fight between the telecoms and financial services institutions over providing financial services play out in the microfinance market? With the caveat that the regulatory environment is exactly the critical input there, and the answer is the quick answer is we shall see, but also the key, we are doing experimentation in Brazil, we're also doing experimentation in Uganda and in Nigeria in developing mobile banking techniques of several sorts. But the key issue is that the regulatory environment for mobile banking is local. In Brazil, the regulator understands mobile banking and is completely open to it. Lemon Bank is a bank that is operating in Brazil with, they don't have any branches at all. And in South Africa, the regulator with Wizit is also operating, although Wizit has several hundred thousand clients, they still haven't gotten to break even. How will it play out? We don't know exactly, but I think that there are going to be a broad range of solutions, all the way from, you know, some banks that will just use text-based information to clients in regulatory environments that do not allow real cash transactions over the telephone, in which the telephone really represents the stored value vehicle. To others like Brazil and South Africa that will allow the telephone to replace your credit card. One of the biggest considerations in the microfinance is going to be literacy, because many of our clients are numerate but not necessarily literate, and anything that you're doing on the phone is going to have some text-based component.
Tom Holland from the South China Morning Post.
Thank you. You spoke about the difficulties of managing credit risk when you're lending to very poor people, and the costs of managing that credit risk.
Yeah.
Now, I understand from one of your opposite numbers at another microfinance institution that the way in which this works is that you make the lending self-policing. In other words, you lend, say, to eight people in one village, and you say to them, right, if any single one of you defaults, none of you get another loan, and you make peer pressure through the door. Now, you didn't mention that. Is that how you work, or have I got the wrong end of the stick?
There are various forms of group lending which absolutely depend on peer pressure to compel repayment. The truth of the matter is the most important element in repayment is not the peer pressure, but the access to the next loan. So if they default, then they don't have access to the next loan. We do group lending, and we intend to do group lending in China, but we are not dogmatic in group lending. We have affiliates all over the world, some of which do group, small group, large group, and individual loans, and use other forms of creative guarantees as well, including a simple co-signer, where, you know, if I want a loan and I'm friends with Tom, and Tom is willing to come down with me to the bank and co-sign my loan, the bank will make the loan to me based on the fact that Tom will vouch for me without studying Tom's ability to actually repay the liability in any way. So there are many forms of creative guarantee that we use, and we're not dogmatic in those methods. We want to use whatever method it will be proved most effective in that market. Some markets, especially as markets mature, group lending doesn't work because the market is mature enough that people know that they can get an individual loan, and then they don't want their access to credit to be limited by anybody else's capacity to repay.
Please introduce yourself.
I was wondering if you could talk us through, I mean, your average loans are about $1,000. How are they structured? What is the interest rate, and what is the repayment schedule on those loans?
Okay, basic terms. Portfolio of $3.6 billion, more or less, includes a wide range of financial products. We have come a long way from the early days. In the early days, my answer would have been they're all solidarity group loans. They're lent to a group of 4 to 8 people who self-select, who receive a loan of approximately $300 to $400 each, and they cross-guarantee it, and it's a 3-month loan. That used to be the methodology 15 years ago when I started. Today, in that portfolio, there are home improvement loans with an average loan size between $2,400 and $5,000 with a 24 to 36-month repayment. There are short-term... Interest rate varies from country to country. From places like Colombia, where the interest rate is capped at 18%, to other countries, the average interest rate is in the 30s, broadly speaking.
So that's more than you get done on your credit card.
Well, it depends what country. In Mexico,
sure, but I mean, yeah.
In Mexico, your credit card could cost you 80%.
Sure, okay. But, I mean, certainly in Hong Kong, I think the maximum, I think, is about 60%. But
16?
60.
Yeah. Well, the interest rate charged is very much dependent on the local market. So we do not have an interest rate policy. Our interest rate policy is we charge what we need to charge in order to get to financial break even, plus some return. No, the motivation is to accomplish both of those things, and that's what's remarkable about microfinance, that if you adhere to the bottom line, you can also provide access to millions of people so that they can develop themselves and their families. But if you do not achieve financial break-even, you won't be able to access capital, and you'll be out of business. So the trade-off is between operating in a financially rational manner and therefore being able to access sufficient capital to grow and reach significant scale, or you could remain a not-for-profit, basically limit your ability to grow and achieve perhaps a more satisfying developmental purity.
So
you can be small and beautiful or big and effective.
Just to make this discussion a little grittier in response to your question, would you, the microfinance operations in China, I understand, are being funded largely by the profits that Acción made from an investment in Mexico and in a company called Compartamos. It's one of the most successful microfinance investments in the world. Would you like to discuss how they've grown in their interest rate policy?
Compartamos?
Yeah.
Sure. Compartamos is a publicly traded bank in Mexico. It's a microfinance bank. We began working with them in 1999. They were formed in 1990 as a Mexican NGO. And between 1990 and 1999, they were able to build up a portfolio of about 25,000 active borrowers in a large group, basically Grameen replication model. In 1999, they came to Acción and requested our technical assistance and an investment in their operations to enable them to begin formalizing the operation. We invested and provided technical assistance, which over the next 3 years enabled them to grow from 25,000 active clients to 500,000 active clients as a finance company because they were able to access capital to fund the portfolio, commercial capital. And then in 2007, when they had reached 800,000 active borrowers, they were able to issue shares on the Mexican market and in the international market in a wildly successful IPO.
Do you want to mention their interest rate policy, which is why I brought it up?
Well, Comportamos charges an effective interest rate of 72%.
Which is actually lower than they charged in much of their formative period.
Right. When they were an NGO, they charged over 100%, and they are by no means the most expensive microfinance institution in Mexico.
So the argument for Comportamos was that even charging 100%, they dramatically brought down the cost of borrowing to many people in Mexico. They dramatically expanded the amount of capital available to people in Mexico. The competing institutions that charged very, very low rates were never able to gain the capital and the infrastructure that was needed to extend credit to people in Mexico. And the profits from Comportamos are doing things like seeding a low-interest loan microfinance operation in China, which they're involved in. So you've touched on a very controversial element of microfinance, and Acción is on all sides of that.
But the fact of the matter is that the primary motivation, you know, the choice is this. We all have a choice. If you want to know what it's like to be a poor person with no access to finance, I invite everybody in the room to take out their wallets and cut up their credit cards and cut up your ATM card and go home and tear up your insurance policies and your pension policy, you know, whatever your retirement benefits are. Tear them all up and then conduct your life with whatever cash you have in your pocket. Okay? And then let's talk about what access to finance means for poor people or for anyone. The fact is that that we are very committed to interest rate policies that are appropriate to the market in which they're delivered and which can provide sufficient return for these institutions to reach nationwide scale and millions of people. And in fact, at the end of the day, and this is our real vision, at the end of the day, have a systemic impact on the provision of financial services. That is, worldwide, somewhere between 5 and 10% of the world actually has access to financial services. But if through demonstrating the financial rationality of microfinance, we can increase that number to 50% market penetration by financial services, we will all live in a very, very different world. So getting financial services to the majority of the world's population will, in fact, fuel economic growth, it'll fuel quality of life improvements, and it'll political and economic stability.
There was another question. Yeah, sure. Please give me indications if you have questions so I can choose one when another one ends.
Jane Brooks.
It's working.
It's working.
I'd like to ask you about some of the other factors you feel are crucial in sustaining a successful microfinance organization. I'm thinking particularly of aspects from the regulatory authorities or some of the other things that make it easier to work in one place than another. For example, I've had it said to me that in China it's somewhat difficult in some areas to operate a successful microfinance organization, partly because a lot of what happens is that you end up doing policy-related lending.
Can you repeat the question?
Yeah. The basic question is, what are the other factors, what are the other key success factors for microfinance? So the first is clearly the regulatory environment. You need to be, ideally, you need to have a fairly liberal interest rate environment. You need to have the ability to leverage a portfolio. You need to be able to capitalize a company and operate it. And you need a regulatory authority that is willing to do the hard work itself to provide prudential regulation of these institutions. It turns out that regulators need to alter the way they look at a financial institution in order to regulate these, and it's a lot more work, and the regulator needs to put a lot into it. You also need, there are some even much more fundamental things. You need effective rule of law. Without rule of law, without the ability for someone to take their profits home at the end of the day, without either the cops or the robbers stealing it from them, fundamental. You also need a cash informal economy. If the economy has been so devastated by whatever that it's reduced to barter, then this is not going to be an environment in which microfinance can succeed. Also, population density is an important factor in microfinance success. Because current models are very high touch and require regular contact between borrowers and loan officers, if the loan officer has to drive, 75 kilometers to see two clients, you're not going to have a cost structure that's supportable.
Again, please introduce yourself and any institution you're affiliated with.
Thanks, Simon. Bonnie Landers, institution. I work for a private family here. My question for Roy, and thank you, Roy, for coming to Hong Kong.
Nice to see you again, Bonnie.
My question would be, can you take those factors you just mentioned and apply it to Chifeng, Inner Mongolia, as the China pilot project?
Yeah.
You know, the Chinese like pilot projects.
Well, so we've got a regulator that has given us a license. Our market research shows that there are probably 500,000 small and very small businesses in Chifeng that could benefit from microfinance. Population density is sufficient. The interest rate environment will be a difficult one. Our license limits us to 4 times the base rate, which base rate is 4% right now. The other regulatory limit we have is this 50% leverage. Normal leverage recommendations for a microfinance institution would be 6 or 7 to 1. We're currently limited to 50% of our initial. No, not 2 to 1. 50%
leverage.
Not 2 to 1. 50%. So basically, the regulator is telling us, well, you lend your money first, and then we'll talk about leveraging it. other than that, obviously, there's a cash, both formal and informal economy. Rule of law is pretty good. So, so what's that, 4 out of 6? It's not bad. The regulatory box that we're in is the thing that makes it most risky for us. Also, market size gives us, and there is a, I didn't mention competitiveness, but there are other competitors in the Chifeng market, most of them, in fact, all of them are serving a higher niche than we intend to serve, but as the market becomes competitive and more competitive, that gap is likely to close.
We have time for a couple more. Just not reading messages and looking at my time. It's 1:56. We try to get out here at precisely 2 o'clock. So we didn't take any questions from over here too. So if any of you would like a question, let me take this one here, and then if any of you have a question over there, you should.
My name is Edward Yun. I'm a guest here. My question is, given what you described is a high-risk lending, a lot of maintenance costs for small size loans.
Yes.
That makes it seem that the people that you have in managing this portfolio is very critical.
Yes.
Given the fact that also you are working in the rural areas, so that part of the country usually does not attract the best people to go. So my question to you, in the case of China in particular, how do you recruit and train your people and keep them?
Well, we have recruited 18 loan officers and 8 managers in the Qifeng area. Many of them are recent college graduates. A few have a minimum amount of banking experience. We were able to recruit them on the basis of this is an important social experiment, and we're paying market rates. We're hiring local people for the loan officers. Management, especially executive management, we're starting with expats and training locals over the first 3 years of the program. This is a key challenge, which so far we have Stanley Kwok, who is the president and CEO of the Inner Mongolia Microcredit Company, is here. He is actually a banker from Hong Kong that was basically retired, and we enticed him out of retirement, and he's brave enough to say, okay, I'll go live in Qifeng for 3 years. But recruitment, and especially recruitment in a rural area and a remote area, is going to be a key challenge. The way I describe it is we're looking for people with a banker's head and a social worker's heart.
There's one question over there in the far corner. I think this is our.
Thank you.
This will be our last question.
I'm Sonia Wang. I'm a guest here. I'm wondering, how do you measure social impact, and what kind of tools do you have to measure that?
Well, the quick answer is that Axion, because we're concentrating on building microfinance institutions that can get to scale, we ourselves do not spend a lot of time or money measuring social impact. There are university groups. Dean Carlin at Yale has developed some very good methods for measuring the impact of microfinance. There are, I just read a study, I guess what you'd call a double-blind study that was done in Hyderabad, India. But broadly speaking, we look at, or researchers look at, increases in household income, and then proxies like children remaining in school, also proxies like quality of housing, the roofing materials, indoor plumbing, et cetera. As you can imagine, quantifying the social and developmental impact of a single input and isolating the cause and effect is quite difficult for researchers. But if you look at, if you go to the microfinancegateway.org, which is a website maintained by the World Bank, there's an excellent library of research. Broadly speaking, the research finds that microfinance improves the quality of lives. And you can find studies there.
You know, we are out of time. How desperate is your question?
I'm not sure if I understand it correctly, that you talk about recently your company or Axion has considered expanding your accessibility to commercial finance. Presumably before, you did not. So is there any difference in your interest rate policy before and after? Because now you probably will have to produce profitability,
yes,
or performance, you know.
Well, let me tell you a quick story about a country very far from here, Bolivia, which actually Bolivia has today perhaps the most advanced and developed commercial microfinance market in the world. Acción opened the first microfinance institution in Bolivia in 1986, and in 1992 opened Banco Sol, which was the first private commercial bank providing services to poor people in the world in La Paz, Bolivia. When we began in 1986, we were the only institution, and we were charging 86%, and frankly, at that time, the poor were paying for our learning and our inefficiency. Today, Bolivia has 8 commercial microfinance institutions that are competing fiercely to provide financial services to poor people, and poor people have a wide range of products and institutions and choices, and the average interest rate that's being charged is the same interest rate as any other commercial borrower, which in Bolivia is around 21-22%. And that is all the effect of effectively building a competitive market in which the institutions had to find ways to be efficient enough to be able to compete not only on price, but service, and they do.
So let's draw this to a halt. I think that we're delighted that Roy could come here, and I think in 3 years, Mr. Kwok or Roy, if you could come back, success or failure, I think your tale would be interesting either way. And so let's give a round of applause, and our president will have a gift to give Mr.
Griffith. Oh, terrific. Thank you very much. And thank you all very much for coming. And if you want to buttonhole me on the way out, I'm more than happy to answer any other questions you have. Yeah, well, you know, I'm prone to...
This way, if you're arrested...
Aaron, I'll hold my gift to... Yeah.
No, this is just looking at
Actually, I work with Grameen Foundation.
Oh, Grameen. So Grameen has people here in Hong Kong?
We just started.
Oh.